I have the privilege and the honor to introduce to you our guest speaker for this retreat, Pastor Justin Young. Justin is the pastor of English and Youth Ministries at Chinese Community Church of Indianapolis. And if I remember correctly, you've been there since 1999, am I correct, Justin? So 1999, that means I was 13 years old when I already began serving at Chinese Community Church of Indianapolis. And now we're in 2024, that's 25 years of serving in that church. And so that's definitely a testimony of faithfulness. He is a graduate of Wooten College, and during his time at Wooten College, he majored in biblical and theological studies. And then after college, he already began serving in the church. And while he was serving at the church, he sensed his call to ministry. And so he continued his education at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, where he received his Master of Divinity. He is married to his wife, Grace, and they have three children together. There are three interests that he mentioned. One is technology, and I think that's really broad. So when I picked him up during the airport, I said, what do you mean by technology? And so he has an interesting answer for that. So during the mealtime, I invite you to ask him, what do you mean, Justin, by technology? That's such a huge, huge broad interest. And then his next one is no less broader, green living. What is green living? Right? So I invite you to ask him about that. And the last thing he also is interested in is essentialism, which I guess we can sort of guess what that is, but I invite you to ask him later during the mealtime, what do you mean by essentialism, that you're interested in essentialism? So with all that, I invite you to join me and give a warm welcome to Pastor Justin Young, who will be guest speaking for us.
All right, so I want to begin with a question. The question is this, so I want you to think about this question and then ask your neighbor this question. Would you rather have anticipation or boredom? So think for a second in your mind, would you rather have anticipation, you're looking forward to something, a little bit of anxiety there because you're not sure what's going to happen, but you're anticipating it, or would you rather just be bored 100%? So think about it, turn to your neighbor, answer the question, you have 45 seconds, go. You're not sure, but you're going to risk it, all right? Complete boredom. All right, all right. So for those of you that said boredom, our two friends here, three, we'll start here. Why did you say boredom? Just curious, anything?
Because I hate anticipation.
You hate anticipation, all right. Is it because of the unknown, or why do you hate anticipation?
Because you have to wait.
Okay, that's fair. Hey, so a lot of you said you'd rather have anticipation. Why would you pick anticipation? Because it's unknown, it's risky, it can turn out bad, it can turn out great. For those of you that said you'd rather have anticipation, why'd you pick anticipation? Anyone want to chime in? Yeah, sorry.
I like looking forward.
Okay, looking forward, awesome, good job. Another question, on a scale of 1 to 5, using your fingers, how much anticipation have you had towards this weekend? 1 being like none, 5 being like let's go, I'm like super excited. Okay, awesome. High five if you have a neighbor. Awesome. Great. So a lot of you have 5s, a lot of you have 1s. My number would be 5. I'm so thankful to be here, be back in New Hampshire, but also just to meet you guys. I love your vibe thus far. It's exciting. And particularly thankful because I recognize that as we come together, we come from a lot of different backgrounds. For example, for some of you, this might be your first time ever coming to like a Christian camp. And if that's your background, like super applause to you. I think that shows a lot of like bravery, like you're stepping into something you don't know. Like for example, if my friend invited me to like a Buddhist youth camp, that would be kind of a stretch. I'd be like, what's this about? But here you are stepping into a Christian youth camp, and maybe you've never stepped foot into this type of gathering before, but here you are, so applause to you. I'm glad you're here. For others of you, you actually are a one or a zero or a negative one, like you don't want to be here, but your parents made you come, because honestly, you don't want to have anything to do with God. But you're here, and I'm thankful you're here. You're very skeptical maybe about things of faith, but you're here, which I think is awesome. I love it when skeptics come and gather and ask questions, because people who are skeptical about the Christian faith have great questions. So hopefully you ask those questions in your small group times. I'm glad you're here. For others of you, you have the right answers, like you're the A-plus student during small group time, but honestly, things of faith are relegated to Sundays and Fridays and retreats, and doesn't really intersect with your life too much at all. I'm glad you're here to think about what would happen if your faith was more than a Friday and Sunday thing, a retreat thing. I'm glad you're here. I'm also glad you're here if you are following God, but internally, you have doubts. Like, you're just not sure, but you don't know how to voice these things. You're scared what happens if you voice these doubts to your friends or your counselor here, what's going to happen. I'm glad you're here, and hopefully you have the safety, if you will, to express these doubts to your group. I'm glad you're here. I'm glad you're here if you're maybe committed to following Jesus, but you're just kind of tired. So this retreat, like, you're here, but it's one more thing to do. I'm glad you're here. And finally, I'm glad you're here if maybe this is the first time you've ever been away from home, more than one night or maybe two nights, and honestly, you haven't told anyone this, but you're a little bit scared because you're away from home. Well, to allay any fears, hey, we have great adults here, great high schoolers here as well, and so hopefully it's going to work out fine. I'm glad you're here. What a gift to be together. No matter your vibe towards coming for this weekend, you are probably looking forward to something. Like, in general, you're looking forward to something. For example, maybe you're looking to that next big life milestone. Some of you are seniors. You're looking forward to graduation in just a few months and moving into what's next, which for many of you might be college. Maybe you're looking forward even beyond that to your first job, or even beyond that, you're looking forward to retirement. For some of you, you're looking forward to going back to school. I heard some of you have Monday off, and maybe you're sad about that because you love school and you can't wait to go to school. Or maybe some of you are looking forward to your next break, which maybe is Thanksgiving break. Maybe you get some time off for that. For others of you, you're looking forward to something in retreat. You have praise fire and s'mores tomorrow. Maybe you love one of those two things. You're looking forward to that. For others of you, you're looking forward to retreat being done. Like, let's go. For others of you, you're just very simple. You're simply looking forward to lunch. Like, you love retreat because all we do is eat and sit and eat and sit and eat and sit and eat and sit and eat some more. Like, you just love that. So you're looking forward to lunch, which is coming up in just a few moments. Whatever it is, you're looking forward to something, and that sense of anticipation captures the sense of the book we're going to walk through this weekend, which is found in the book of Numbers. If you have a Bible, I invite you to turn to the book of Numbers. It is actually, if you're not familiar with the Bible, the fourth book in the Bible. So if you have a paper Bible, you can just go to the fourth book and use the table context. No shame there. So it goes Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and then Numbers. Check out the book of Numbers. We're going to be camping out in that book this weekend. So Numbers is where we're going to be. I invite you to turn there. So if you're not familiar with the Bible, just a quick primer here. The Bible is a book, but it's also a book of books. That there's a bunch of books that make up this book of the Bible. And there's a story that goes like this. So in the beginning, which is in the book of Genesis, everything starts. God creates humanity. It's good. It's actually very good. But then humans fall into sin. They rebel against God, and God doesn't give up. However, God is on this rescue mission, and he begins this rescue mission through a guy, ultimately, whose name is Abraham. And he says to Abraham, go from your country, your kindred, your father's house, the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. So God starts his rescue plan through a guy named Abraham. He says, I'm going to make a nation, and from this rescue plan, someone's going to come to redeem the world. So Abraham has a son named Isaac, who has a son named Jacob, and Jacob has lots of sons, 12 tribes, and they make up this people known as the Israelites. And the Israelites grow quite a bit. They multiply a lot. So then when you enter the second book of the Bible, Exodus, this is what you find. Joseph, who's one of the sons of Jacob, died, and all his brothers and all that generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so the land was filled with them. So this people that God promised to Abraham back in Genesis 12, they grow, and there's a ton of them. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, and the land was filled with them. And so what happens is that there's this new king in this country of Egypt, and he doesn't like this people group is are growing. And so he actually enslaves them. But then God delivers them out of slavery. It's called the Exodus. He delivers them out of Egypt. He brings them to Mount Sinai and makes this promise, this covenant with them. He says, I will be your God, you will be my people, and I will dwell amongst you. But there's a problem here. And you hear the problem in the beginning of that third book, Leviticus. See if you can hear it. The Lord called to Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting. In other words, there's a division. How do we approach this holy God? So Moses is speaking. Lord is calling to Moses from the tent of meeting. So Leviticus is all about how do you approach God. And it works because as you walk into the book of Numbers, known as the preposition change, the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness in Sinai in the tent of meeting. So no longer from the tent of meeting, but in the tent of meeting. Moses can approach the Lord now because of what we learned in Leviticus. And so here we are in the book of Numbers. Let's talk a little bit about this book, Numbers. So in our Bibles, it's called Numbers. But actually, that wasn't the original name of this book. So if you're not familiar with the Bible, there's basically two sections, the Old Testament and the New Testament. The Old Testament was actually written mostly in the language called Hebrew. And so the Hebrew name for the book of Numbers is actually In the Wilderness. In the Wilderness. Because Numbers chronicles these 40 years that God's people are wandering in the wilderness prior to entering the promised land, prior into this land that God has promised his people. So they're wandering in the wilderness. So it makes sense that the Hebrew name, the original name for this book, is In the Wilderness. Which raises the question, well, how do we get the name Numbers? Like, Numbers sounds like a Sesame Street episode. Well, the Old Testament was at one point translated into Greek, and so when they were translating it into Greek, those people gave it the Greek name of Numbers. Because numbers are actually kind of important in the book of Numbers, because there's two censuses in the book of Numbers. One in chapter 1, which we'll look at a little bit this morning, and one in chapter 26. And so they keyed in upon that and said, let's call it Numbers. But here's a little tip. If you combine the Hebrew name for the book of Numbers, In the Wilderness, with the Greek name, or the name that we call it, Numbers, if you smash them together, you get a good picture for what the book of Numbers is all about. For example, think about the content of the book of Numbers. It's the wilderness wanderings between Egypt and the promised land. And the structure of this is basically found between these two censuses that pop up in chapter 1 and chapter 26. So like those two censuses are like hammock poles, right? There's one in chapter 26, it's a bunch of stuff that happens. One in chapter 1, and then one in chapter 26. So there's that framework there of these numbers or these censuses that go together. So here's my hot take. If there were ever like the NJV, the New Justin Version of the Bible, I would rename the book of Numbers simply Between. Because it captures the content, right? God's people are wandering in the wilderness between redemption out of Egypt, but they're not yet into the promised land. We're kind of between realities, if you will. And it also captures the structure. Because a lot of this happens between chapter 1, the census there, and chapter 26, the census there. That sounds like a great theme for a retreat as well. All right, so let me just frame out what's going on in the book of Numbers, then we'll look specifically in chapter 1. So in the first 10 chapters, basically you have this first generation that they're preparing to march the promised land. And so the first 10 chapters, there's like this optimistic vibe because they've just been delivered out of Egypt. They're about to go into this promised land. They're super excited, and there's just optimism that's pervading the text here. It's kind of like football players in the tunnel. They're about to go out and play this football game, and they're all excited. They've been preparing all season for this game. They're super excited, and they're very optimistic. So that's the vibe of these first 10 chapters. High optimism, high delight here. But then, chapter 10, chapter 11, it's like a record scratch. Because now the first generation is faithlessness, rather, is shown, and they get punished in the wilderness because they sin. We'll take a look at that tomorrow. It's kind of like, I don't know if you've watched Star Wars, episode 3 is my least favorite episode. Because in episode 1, here, hear me out, you meet Anakin. Oh, cute Anakin. He's a good racer. Episode 2, teenage Anakin, protect Padme. But then in episode 3, the whole episode, at least from my perspective, is just like, no, because Anakin turns to the dark side. You know it's coming, but it happens. And that's the vibe that I get as you walk into chapters 10 and 11 and following in the book of Numbers, because it's like, oh, they're about to enter the promised land. But then they fall into sin. Kind of grumbling that's happening here. In fact, if you're familiar at all with the book of Numbers, maybe that idea of grumbling is pervasive in your mind. Some people ask, why is Numbers so contemporary today? There's this comic that came out some time ago. And people are asking, why would we ever study the book of Numbers? 26 chapters of self-centered people who whine every time they didn't get their way. Give us something relevant. It's kind of the vibe here you get in a lot of Numbers, that people are complaining and whining all the time. They find that last section of the book of Numbers is the second generation. That first generation dies out, that second generation's preparation to march to the promised land, and again, that part begins with the census, just like chapter 1 does. So, what I want to do briefly in our time together this morning is look at chapter 1 and think about how the census, which honestly, as we read through it, it's going to seem super irrelevant, particularly to your life. I think there's actually something unbelievably relevant that applies to us even today. So let's take a look at chapter 1 and see what's happening here. So let me read, starting in chapter 1, verse 1, and then we're going to jump forward after verse 4. So follow along if you have a Bible. The Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, in the tent of meeting, on the first day of the second month, in the second year after they'd come out of the land of Egypt, saying, take a census of all the congregation of the people of Israel by clans, by father's house, according to the number of names, every male head by head. From 20 years old and upward, all of Israel who are able to go to war, you and Aaron shall list them, company by company. And there shall be with you a man from each tribe, each man being the head of the house of his fathers. So we're going to scroll forward. If you have a Bible, you can see there's lots of names here. We're going to scroll down to verse 16. Pick it up again. So after all these names, these were the ones chosen from the congregation, the chiefs of their ancestral tribes, the heads of the clans of Israel. Moses and Aaron took these men who had been named, and on the first day of the second month, they assembled the whole congregation together who registered themselves by clans, by fathers' houses, according to the number of names from 20 years old and upward, head by head, as the Lord commanded Moses. So he listed them in the wilderness of Sinai. And again, if you have a Bible, you can skim it, and there's lots of names here. We're going to drop down all the way down towards the end of verse 44 and pick up one last excerpt here. Verse 44. So these are the names of those who were listed, whom Moses and Aaron listed with the help of the chiefs of Israel, 12 men, each representing his father's house. So all those listed of the people of Israel by their father's houses, from 20 years old and upward, every man able to go to war in Israel, all those listed were 603,550. But the Levites were not listed along with them by their ancestral tribe. Verse 48. For the Lord spoke Moses, saying, only the tribe of Levi you shall not list, and you shall not take a census of them among the people of Israel. Verse 50. But appoint Levites over the tabernacle of the testimony, and over all its furnishings, and over all that belongs to it. They are to carry the tabernacle and the furnishings, and to take care of it, and they shall camp around the tabernacle. Verse 51. When the tabernacle is to set up, the Levites shall take it down. And when the tabernacle is to be pitched, the Levites shall set it up. And if any outsider comes near, he shall be put to death. Verse 52. The people of Israel shall pitch their tents by their companies, each man in his own camp, and each man by his own standard. But the Levites shall camp around the tabernacle of the testimony, so that there may be no wrath on the congregation of the people of Israel. And the Levites shall keep guard over the tabernacle of the testimony. And finally, verse 54. Thus did the people of Israel. They did according to all the Lord commanded Moses. So big question here. We just read through that. It's like, what's the point of it? What do we learn in this census? Let me give you two big ideas. But even before that, just think practically. Why would they want to measure how many people they have here? Well, part of it is to prepare for war. They're about to take this land over, and they need to know how many guys they have that can fight. For example, if you've ever played any kind of sports, you know there's a minimum number of players you need to play. So for example, I coached my son's soccer team, and in the league that he was in, it was 9v9. And so I asked parents, hey, let me know if your kid can't come, because we need to know that for the roster. So one game we had last spring was super hot. We had 6 players. Well, if we had known that beforehand, playing a 9v9 game with 6 players, that's a problem. So just a really practical level here, what do we learn? Why is this even in here? Part of it is just so that they can know how many people they have for the census for this war they're going into. But beyond that, let me give you kind of 2 other ideas here. Number one, this celebrates God's corporate faithfulness. The reality here is that this is showing that God has been faithful. How do we know that? Remember, we mentioned in our kind of overview of the Bible thus far that God made this promise, this covenant with Abraham. And he said to Abraham back in Genesis 12, I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. And a little bit later in that same book, God brings Abraham outside and says, look toward heaven and number the stars. If you're able to number them, so shall your offspring be. In other words, God has promised Abraham many years before this, Abraham, I'm going to make you into a great nation. Which, if you know the story, it's kind of crazy. Because at this point, Abraham's a nomad, his wife's barren. Like, how are they going to have kids, much less a whole nation? So much so, like the stars outside, you can't count how many people there are. No. You see that here. God has been faithful. But you also remember, back in Genesis, God has also said, I'm going to give you land. Genesis 17. I will give to you and your offspring after you the land of the sojourners, all the land of Canaan for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. So in other words, as you walk into Numbers, you're starting to see, oh, God was faithful. Just like he said back in Genesis, like, I'm going to give you all these people. You count all these people, and we skimmed over so much of it, and it's hard to read, right? But the point is, there's a lot of people now. God was faithful to his promise to give Abraham this people. And so God will then be faithful as well to take the land, because they're not taking the land yet. They're in between. They've seen redemption, they've seen the growth of the people, but they haven't taken the land yet. So there's this question, is God going to be faithful? And so you step back, and in Numbers, you're like, oh wait, God has been faithful to this part of this promise of having lots of people. Therefore, he indeed will be faithful as we enter this land, which he has also promised. And throughout the book of Numbers, they're so close. For example, Numbers 26, notice where they're at. In the plains of Moab, by the Jordan at Jericho. So they're just about to enter the promised land. And so as you walk through the book of Numbers, you might wonder, wow, are they ever going to enter the promised land? They're so close, but yet they're so far away. Because as we'll see, particularly tomorrow, things go awry. The people do a lot of dumb things. You're like, oh, are they really going to enter the promised land ever? It's in those moments that we as the reader need to be reminding ourselves of, well, God has been faithful. Remember in Numbers 1, all those people, God promised that way back in Genesis 12. He's fulfilled that part of the promise. And also, God promised in Genesis as well that you will enter the promised land. Do you see how that ties together? For example, if you watch football, you know the Kansas City Chiefs are a very strong team. They're on track to maybe win their 3rd Super Bowl championship, something no other NFL team has done in a row. And so when you watch the Chiefs, you're like, oh, they're not going to win. But then you remember, they always find a way. Like there's this Mahomes magic. Like somehow he always finds a way to win. In a much greater sense, as you walk through Numbers, you might be wondering, are they ever going to enter the promised land? And at those times, you have to remind yourself of chapter 1, because God was faithful. God promised in Genesis, I'm going to give you people, I'm going to give you land. God has given them people. There's tons of people now. 600,000 people were counted here. Therefore, he will be faithful to his promise regarding the land as well. And so for us, when you're tempted to doubt God's faithfulness in the future, you need to remember his faithfulness in the past. When you're tempted to doubt God's faithfulness in the future, you've got to remember his faithfulness in the past. For example, there's an old song which says, count your blessings. It goes like this. When upon life's billows you are tossed, when you're discouraged thinking all is lost, count your many blessings, name them one by one. It will surprise you what the Lord has done. When you're tempted at God's faithfulness in the past, you've got to think about the past. Faithfulness in the future, you've got to remember his faithfulness in the past. Psalm 145 says something similar. On the glorious splendor of your majesty and on your wondrous works, I will meditate. Like, there's a biblical rationale for thinking about what God has done in the past so that you can go into the future full of faith. Now, this sounds very sentimental, like, oh yes, count your many blessings. But this is aggressive. This is not passive. This is fighting for faith. Our devotion this morning was talking about guarding against passivity, but rather spring ourselves onto action and fighting for faith. There's a song that's popular these days, simply called Praise, and one of the lines in the song goes like this: Praise is my weapon, it's more than a sound. Praise is the shout that brings Jericho down. Like, there's an aggressiveness to that. As you meditate on God's faithfulness in the past, that is not just some sentimentality. That's an act of war, that's an act of fighting, because we remember God's faithfulness in the past, therefore we can press forward into the future with faithfulness as well. But sometimes, you don't have the faith to do that. Like, sometimes your life gets so turned upside down that it's just hard to think about anything else, and you freak out, and you wonder what's going to happen. That's where community comes in. That's why I'm so thankful, you know, for both of your youth groups from different churches. You have people around you to speak truth into your life and you can't see anything else. So when I come to retreats, I think back to one retreat that I was at many years ago. And something happened that had never happened to me up until that point in my life. So it's the middle of the night and everybody's sleeping. But I wake up and I feel just a little bit sick. Like, nothing crazy, but I just feel like, oh, I don't feel great. But then, I don't know if you've ever had this happen to you. You get a thought, and that thought starts to be amplified exponentially. And all of a sudden, that thought is like a train which has lost its brakes going down a mountain. Like, it starts slowly, but all of a sudden it starts gaining steam. It starts gaining traction. And all of a sudden, that little thought that was just like a seed before starts blowing up in your mind, and you start going places that you never thought you'd go before in terms of your mind. Whoa. So, I wake up in the middle of the night, everyone's asleep, and I feel not so great. Not a big deal. But all of a sudden, maybe it was just because it was the middle of the night, I don't know what happened, but all of a sudden I start thinking, oh no. And so my pulse starts being elevated. My breathing is also equally rapid, and I'm like, and it goes ultimately, I'm gonna die. Like, what's gonna happen, right? And that could be your problem. I die in the middle of this youth retreat. And so anyway, I'll spare you all the details, but it just gets amplified and amplified, and I'm like, and so eventually I did something I've never done either to that point or since. And so I wake up one of the adult counselors and I'm like, yo, bro, I think I'm gonna die. And he is able to speak truth in my life and say, basically, you're not gonna die. Just calm down. Now, in retrospect, and it wasn't until years later that I discerned this, and many of you probably can figure this out already, I was having a panic attack. Like, I didn't realize it. That was a panic attack. I wasn't really going to die, but my mind was thinking that, but I needed someone from the outside to speak into my life and say, calm down, you're not going to die. Now, lest you be on the edge of your seat for the rest of our time together this morning, I want to tell you the rest of the story. I did not die. Okay. I know. So we need people around us when we can't see faith in the future to speak into your life, to say something like, hey, I care about you, I empathize with you, I understand somewhat of what you're going through, but let me speak truth into your life. Let me encourage you that God is faithful. He has always been faithful. He will continue to be faithful to you in the years to come. When you're tempted to doubt God's faithfulness in the future, remember his faithfulness in the past. And when you do that, remember the cornerstone of our faith. Did you notice in the very opening verse what they're rooting this in? The Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness in the tent of meeting, here it is, on the first day of the second month in the second year after they'd come out of the land of Egypt. What is the root of that? What's the ground of that in terms of the dating here? The first day of the second month in the second year after they'd come out of the land of Egypt. They're dating it based on the Exodus. Do you see that? It's been 2 years since we've come out of Egypt, so God delivered us out of Egypt. So they're basing that on the deliverance out of Egypt. So if you're a Christian, you know, we have something similar. The year is 2024, which is roughly 2,000 years since the death and resurrection of Jesus. And so when you're tempted to doubt God's faithfulness in the future, remember how he's been faithful in the past, which is many ways, but the apex of it is the cross. What God does for us, what we can never do for ourselves in redeeming us through Jesus. When you're tempted to doubt God's faithfulness in the future, remember his faithfulness in the past. So that's one reason I think that sentence is put here. To remind God's people of his corporate faithfulness. He's big, he's grand, he's majestic, he does what he says he's going to do. But there's another reason. Number two, it also highlights God's personal call. It reminds you of your identity here. Let me read you a quote and I'll explain it. Here's what one scholar says about this census. He says this: a census could function to remind individual Israelites that they had a place within their collective people of God. Now this had at least two effects. On the one hand, to hear your tribe being called out among the covenant people of God was to hear a declaration that you also were a member of that same covenant people, and therefore an heir of the promises of God. On the other hand, to hear your tribe called out among the other tribes was to remind you that these tribes were also your covenant brothers and sisters to whom you owed faithfulness and love. The Israelites were thus to rejoice in the covenant promises that were theirs and to reaffirm their commitment to the covenant king as well as to their covenant brothers and sisters. Let me give you an illustration. Have you ever been to like a high school graduation? So when I ask people in our church, hey, did you go to your brother's graduation? Yes. How was it? Almost without fail, they respond with one word: boring, right? Because, and I understand it, the high school that a lot of our kids go to is over 5,000 kids. So you can imagine, at graduation, they read every name. And so you're sitting through 1,234 names. Totally get it. That would be pretty boring. That said, think about this. While you may not have cared for 1,233 of those names, there's one name that you did care about. And if they skipped over that name, or if they mispronounced that name, like, you would appropriately be up in arms. Why? Because you came there because you wanted to hear your brother's name. Like, it matters if they don't skip over that name. Because hearing your name or their brother's name reminds you that he is part of that community. He is part of that graduating class. And so there's a similar sense here. The census reminds the Israelites, you know, very granular here. Oh, we're part of this community here. God is big and majestic and huge. He's corporately faithful to our people from Abraham till now. But also he cares on an individual level. He cares about these names here. He cares about my tribe. There's a personal call that's happening here. Not only is God faithful to his people as a whole, but he's faithful to these little tribes, these individuals as well. I think that's true as well today. So to illustrate this, let me tell you a story, or read you a story. It's a kid's story called The Flyaway Kite. And it ties this idea that God has a personal call on your life as well. So let me read this, make a comment, and pray. The Flyaway Kite. The little red kite felt handsome. It was so proud of its shiny, fresh paint. A gentle tug from the boy who had made the kite reminded it of the string that connected them. From the very beginning, it flew higher and better than any kite ever, looping, zooming, climbing, or diving. The kite loved to fly anywhere the boy directed it. The kite knew the boy loved it too. Every day they would have a new adventure. Sometimes the kite flew so high it nearly disappeared into the sky. At other times it flew so fast it would chase the birds right through the clouds. After a while, though, the little kite began to tire of these tricks. I don't like this string, it said to itself. I don't want to be controlled by the boy. I want to be free. The kite began to pull and tug at the string that connected it to the boy. Finally, the string broke. And the kite was carried away with the wind. I'm free! I'm free! It shouted. But the little kite didn't fly or loop or zoom like it had expected. To its great surprise, the kite discovered that it really wasn't free after all. You see, kites can't fly unless they're connected to their owners by a string. It just fell from the sky, blowing wherever the wind took it. But the boy followed. Oh no, the kite said, as it crashed into the top of a jagged stone mountain. The boy climbed the mountain, but the wind blew the kite away. Help! It cried as it tumbled down through the snow and rocks and was caught high in a scraggly tree. The boy climbed the tree, but the wind tore the kite from the branches. Ouch! The kite shrieked as an eagle snatched it up and began to rip off pieces to use for its nest. The boy came upon the eagle just as the wind took what was left of the kite and tossed it over a cliff. "Save me," the kite gurgled as it was thrown headfirst into a rushing river. It rolled over and over and smashed against the boulders. The boy followed the kite, but it was washed far out to sea. Cold and frightened, the little kite sank deep into the ocean. The boy dived down to get the kite, but a shark carried it away. A fisherman caught the shark and saw the kite. He just laughed at the sight and threw the ragged thing away. The battered kite sighed with relief when the boy found it in a dumpster. He carried it home. "You're safe again, little kite," he said. "I have you now." The weak and tired kite lay quietly on the workbench as the boy carefully cleaned off the seaweed and slime. It was comforted by the boy's loving hands as he patched and repaired it. Step by step, the little kite began to feel beautiful once again. When the work was done, the boy carried the kite, little red kite, up to their favorite hill and said to it, "I made you to fly high and free, my little kite. And as long as you stay connected to me, you always will." With a gentle tug on the string, the little kite floated into the breezy sky. If you had been a bird flying by and had listened very carefully, you would have heard the little kite answer the boy and say, "Yes, this is just where I belong." See, God's call in our life is to be connected to Him. We will never find rest apart from Him. We might think, "I want to be free. I want to be divorced from God." But ultimately, that leads, like the little kite found out, to nothing good. We're not made to live life apart from Him. But God in His love pursues us like the little boy, and at great cost to Himself, namely His Son, does for us what we could never do for ourselves. He redeems us and brings us back to Himself so that we can have that new relationship with Him. Yes, in Numbers, you see that beautiful, massive God that fulfills His promises, but you also see the intimacy of God. He cares on an individual basis as well. Let's pray together. Father, would you help us to rejoice in what we've learned of you today, that you, yes, are massive and big and great, and you fulfill this massive promise corporately to your people, but you also care about them individually. So, Father, help us to rejoice in that truth and respond not with passivity, but with action, that we might know you to a great degree, even this weekend. For this we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.